the international community, like the folks in Denmark, such as yourself and others, pick up the slack? What impact is the Trump administration's assault on this going to have on our ability to prepare?
Well, fortunately, science is a team sport, and it is clearly it's a blow when a large country which has had some of the leading research or researchers pulls themselves out of the game, as it were. But there's a lot of capacity to take up the slack, and I guess you can say that the front lines won't move as quickly as they might have done, but I feel very confident that the front lines are still moving forward. It's still a team sport. There are other groups beginning to take up the slack in terms of the databases and so on that are no longer available in the United States. And what worries me more than the science itself and how much we're learning and how much we're doing. What worries me more is if and how the American players will be able to get back into the game when conditions change, because there's also a power balance in science, and it's clear that the power balance also there is changing.
And you write, you and your colleagues write, addressing the various threats requires stronger policy frameworks that accelerate emissions reductions and integrate tipping point risks into global climate planning. Are tipping point risks being incorporated into global climate planning to the extent that global climate planning is actually taking place?
Well, you're certainly beginning to see it. You have Iceland that has declared the risk of the AMOC, of the current that brings heat up to Northern Europe, of that collapsing is a national security risk. So we're certainly beginning to see that kind of consideration. Not everywhere, obviously, but there's a lot of focus here in Northern Europe right now about what and if and how and, you know, what is it if we're supposed to adapt? What are we adapting to? Are we adapting to a much warmer world, or are we adapting to a much, much colder world? And will we be a farming nation in the future? And where will our food security come from if we're not able to farm in, and so on? So I do see that discussion coming up. No, it's not where I think it should be, but I do see evolution in the way people are considering this.
But there have been lots of articles, I think, I read this stuff over the last several years, talking about tipping points. And it's always the same community of people, like Timothy Lenton in Exeter and yourself, and naturally Johan Rockström and in Potsdam and in Sweden. And there's a lot of talk about tipping points, but it seems the last thing you'd expect world leaders, quote unquote, to think about and start incorporating into their strategies today than tipping points, which take perhaps, you know, are we in one? Have we exceeded one? You know, maybe we're 100 years into passing the tipping point and nothing's going to be happening terribly soon, but we're on the path of no return. This is not the kind of stuff that world leaders think about.
On the other hand, I think you're right. I think tipping points aren't something they're thinking about, but I do think that world leaders generally have not lost the agenda of climate and the Earth system as being important to respect. I mean, I think we're on a journey at the moment where we're realizing that we are a part of an ecosystem, not just that we are an organism as Darwin caused us to realize, but that we are a part of an ecosystem and that we need to respect that ecosystem in order to continue to thrive. And I think that journey actually began the first time we got pictures of the Earth from space. Now, that was the late 60s, and it took a long time. That was before Brundtland. I mean, we're on this journey. More and more people are understanding where we are now. And I like to use the example, we haven't mentioned it here, but I'm part of, together with Johan Rockström and Will Steffen, we were the three original architects of the planetary boundaries framework. And that's a framework where we say, okay, this is just about climate. It's also biodiversity and water and so on. And how much can we actually take out? And we've had three different iterations, three different papers in the international literature on this. The first in 2009 that Johan Rockström led, then one in 2015 that Will Steffen led, and then one that I led in 2023. And the one that Will Steffen led in 2015, after 8 years, had been downloaded 275,000 times, which is huge for a scientific article. But the one that I led in 2023, which is not necessarily a better article than the one that Will led, the one that I led in 2023 has now been downloaded after 2 years almost 800,000 times. So there's a growing group of people that there's a growing understanding, I think, for the fact that we need to respect the ecosystem we're a part of. And in Europe right now, we're obviously, everyone is in the geopolitical situation, has all of the news, but we want to talk about the future, about what we're going to compete on in the future in terms of, you know, in terms of economic competition and so on. And in that case, we have to look towards China. And China has really, really been investing in climate and climate mitigation, in biodiversity, in pollution. The air pollution in China has gone way, way down. So if we're going to compete with these people in the future, we have to keep this on the agenda.
And we need to be cooperating with China, it would seem to me. Instead, the leaders of the world say, you know, it's a malign entity. Of course, you know, the Mark Carney in Canada is reaching out to the Chinese and trying to work out a trade deal. And they look like they're friendly, but China is considered to be, you know, at best, an irreconcilable competitor, and at worst malign, instead of seeing it as a partner in achieving, climate sustainability.
There's absolutely a different culture. There's absolutely a different form of governance, which frightens many of us. But the reality is China is there. China is in a very powerful position, an increasingly powerful position, and China has announced they have an ecological civilization, and they're making some changes that we all could learn from.
Huh. So I want to ask you a last question, getting back to the hothouse earth idea, and I kind of imagine that people in the Trump administration will say, well, you know, 15 million years ago, Earth was a hothouse. So clearly there were no human beings around 15 million years ago. It was a hothouse. So we're on some kind of warming trajectory now. Maybe humans are responsible. Maybe they're not. They probably aren't. But what the heck? You know, what should we be worried about? Hothouse Earth. We're on the trajectory.
Well, you know, I'm not sitting here saying that we should worry that it's a hothouse earth. I think the really important message here is not that I'm saying that's going to happen or that we're saying that's going to happen, but that we're emphasizing we must be more humble. We don't know what we're doing to the system that we're in. And that uncertainty is something that we should react to. We wouldn't take, if there's some new chemical that we found, we have no idea what it's going to do to our body, we wouldn't drink it. Our reaction would be to use profound caution when we're seeing that we're dealing with something entirely new. And I think that's the real message that we need to be getting across. It's not just a question of whether we're going to be able to take off our overcoats in the wintertime or whether we will have more days on the beach. It's a question of we really don't know what we're doing to the conditions that have supported the evolution of all civilization on human civilization on Earth. And do we really think it's a good idea to mess with those conditions. I think that's the real message, not that we should sit here focusing on to be or not to be a hothouse earth. We're a part of this system. We're not placed over it. It's not us that decides. We have to have respect for the ecosystem we're a part of.
And we really believe that we are incredibly sophisticated. We've got these artificial intelligence models, and people are worried that artificial intelligence is going to take over the world and humanity is doomed because what AI systems are going to do to us. But meanwhile, here we are living on this tiny little planet, and we really, for all intents and purposes, have no idea how it works.
Well, the tiny little planet has no umbilical cord. So we know that the resources that are here are what we have to work with. And then we can ask ourselves, how did nature survive for 3.5 billion years on a planet with limited resources? And it did it by A, being incredibly efficient in its resource use, and by B, developing 100% circular resource economy. So we know how to live on a planet with limited resources. Nature tells us how it happens. We just need to be more humble and learn from others.
Catherine Richardson, thank you so much for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor.
Pleasure, David.
Catherine Richardson is Principal Investigator at the Center for Macroecology, Evolution, and Climate, and Professor of Biological Oceanography at the University of Copenhagen. She co-authored the groundbreaking 2009 study that introduced the Planetary Boundaries Safe Operating Space concept. We shall link to that study and to the Hothouse Earth Trajectory paper that's just been published at greenplanetmonitor.net. We'll also post a video of our conversation with Catherine Richardson. After this brief break, we'll listen back to the conversation the GPM had with Will Steffen before his untimely passing. You are listening to the GPM. I'm David Kattenberg. Surface is a little over 1 degree warmer today on average than it was at the start of the Industrial Revolution 250 years ago. Doesn't seem like much. Under the Paris Agreement, governments agreed to limit temperature rise to 1.5 degrees. That target seems to have been exceeded. In a landmark report published in the prestigious Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences back in 2018, researchers warned that a 2-degree rise in global surface temperature may actually exceed a critical planetary threshold, pushing Earth down a cascade of tipping points into hothouse mode, unlike anything this third rock from the sun has experienced since the mid-Miocene epoch 15 million years ago. I spoke with the lead author of that report, Will Steffen, before his untimely passing. As a lead-in to this, talking a bit about this paper that you've co-authored, you were the first author, Trajectories of the Earth System in the Anthropocene. You're associated with these ideas together with Johan Rockström of planetary boundaries and safe operating space, which is kind of apropos to our conversation right now.
Absolutely. Johan came up with the idea of planetary boundaries, and they are designed to say what is required to keep the Earth in a Holocene state, the Holocene being the last approximately 12,000-year geological epoch. It's the last interglacial in that series of glacial-interglacial cycling, and it's very important for humans because during the last 12 years, we've developed agriculture, settlements, more complex societies, etc. So the idea of the planetary boundaries was to explore, using the best science we could, how far can you push the Earth system and various important processes in the Earth system before you transgress Holocene bounds and move the system onto another state. This paper is a natural follow-on to the planetary boundaries in a way, saying we know that we're exceeding some of the planetary boundaries. We know we've actually left the Holocene. There's an enormous amount of evidence. We're in what Paul Crutzen has termed the Anthropocene. But that the Earth system's not in a stable state now. It's in a highly transient state. And where might it go? So that was the motivation for bringing together 13 or 14 scholars from around the world who are all interested in and are experts in various aspects of this question. So that was really the motivation for the paper.
And that that other notion of safe operating space suggests that Earth is no longer, seemingly thanks largely to human beings, Earth is no longer at a steady state, and it may potentially no longer at some point, it may no longer be a safe operating space for human beings.
Yeah, in fact, one could make the argument because some of the planetary boundaries, the two really important ones, climate change and biosphere integrity, have already been transgressed. Biosphere integrity probably more seriously. You could argue that we're no longer really in a safe operating space, and we can already see that in a way. For example, with the increase in extreme weather events, heat waves, more intense tropical cyclones, bushfires, that sort of thing, it's telling us we're no longer really in a safe operating space. And of course, it's really the most vulnerable people around the planet who are already starting to feel the impacts of that.
And these crazy wildfires, I mean, this evening on the news here in Canada, stories about how there are now, hundreds of fires stretching all the way from Fort St. John in northern British Columbia all the way down to the lower mainland.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's amazing. And also, of course, we're seeing an increase in fires in the Siberian boreal forest, which are the equivalent type of forest over on the other side of the Atlantic. Sweden's seen a lot of fires, wildfires in their forests this year. And, of course, we had the tragic fires in Greece that killed a few people. We have our own type of wildfire here called bushfires, which roar through eucalyptus forests in the southeast primarily, and they're on the increase also. So all of this evidence, like what you're pointing to in Canada, is evidence that we're no longer in a safe operating space. We're in a transient phase. The Earth system is shifting. It's no longer in a stable state. And the question is, what trajectory might it take in the future, and what is the role of humans in that trajectory?
Well, let's get to that shortly. But in terms of this notion of possible slipping or sliding into hothouse Earth, how hot could it get if things we slipped into that uncontrollable mode? How hot could planet Earth, surface the Earth, get?
Well, we're suggesting 4 to 5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial, and that's based on paleoclimate analogs. That if we go toward mid-Miocene conditions, which is about 15 million years ago, so it's not all that long ago, really, in Earth history. That's the last time we saw CO2 up between 400 to 500 parts per million, and the temperatures were 4 to 5 degrees higher. A big range of estimates of sea level rise, probably at least 10 meters higher than today, but it could go as high as 30 or 40 meters higher eventually. So we know that in the very recent past, the Earth is actually capable of being in such a state. So our analysis suggests that if we do cross what we're proposing as a planetary threshold and trigger a lot of feedbacks that put more carbon into the atmosphere, as well as decrease ice much more rapidly, and therefore increase the absorption of sunlight, you could very well get to mid-Miocene conditions. And we say it could be as fast as a century or two.
And that would be a global average. You speak about 4 to 5 degrees Celsius post-industrial. That would be a global average. You'd see exceedances, temperature rises way higher than that.
Yeah, in fact, we're already seeing that. You know, we had an excursion in the Arctic region of somewhere around 30 degrees Celsius above average for a couple of weeks, which is absolutely remarkable. But I think if you just look at average, the northern high latitudes, and of course this is very important for Canada, the northern high latitudes are warming at roughly twice the global rate. So if that ratio holds in the future, you could see temperatures 8 to 10 degrees higher than pre-industrial in the northern high latitudes.
What is a positive feedback? And can you describe some of these sorts of positive feedbacks that happen?
Yeah, positive is probably not a good word for the general public. It's one we use in science. Positive means reinforcing. It means it reinforces the driving force that triggered the feedback in the first place. So basically in our paper, we look at two types of these feedbacks, carbon cycle feedbacks and ice albedo feedbacks. But a good example of a carbon cycle feedback is, in fact, what we've just been talking about, the vast boreal northern forests. And they store a lot of carbon, and they could act as a carbon sink if they are healthy and maintained in a viable state. But as they are increasingly at risk of burning, which we've talked about, but also insect infestation, the spruce bark beetle is a classic case there. It's affected a lot of forests in British Columbia, for example. What's happening is as these forests are weakened by insect attacks and then burn, they are releasing carbon back to the atmosphere. Interestingly, the best data we have actually comes from Canada. It comes from the Canadian Forest Service. And they've been doing very meticulous surveys of the carbon dynamics of those forests over a century. And what they find is that indeed, up until around 1970 or so, the Canadian boreal forests were actually removing carbon from the atmosphere in a net sense. But as the temperature has warmed, you get more fires, more insects, and these forests are now at best carbon neutral, and in bad years, they're actually a net emitter of carbon to the atmosphere. So this is a positive feedback. The earth warms, it makes Canadian boreal forests more vulnerable, they burn, they emit carbon to the atmosphere, and it warms it even more.
And then the reduction of Earth's albedo, talk about that.
Yeah, well, that happens as ice sheets shrink. Again, the most vulnerable one is the Arctic sea ice, summer sea ice. So this is the ice that floats over the Arctic Ocean during summertime. Normally, it would be a few meters thick. It's not only been thinning out, it's also been decreasing in area. So when it decreases in area in the summertime, of course, that's when the sun is over the far north. Instead of reflecting sunlight, it's absorbing. The darker ocean water absorbs sunlight. And this leads to further regional warming. And, of course, as it warms further, the ice shrinks further back, which uncovers even more water. It warms even more and so on. This is another example of a feedback loop. So we're talking about two types of positive feedback loops, one involving the carbon cycle, the other involving ice albedo effect.
And then you conjure up the notion of tipping points that, you know, as Earth's system warms, accelerated by positive feedbacks of various types, we theoretically approach a tipping point where suddenly things go completely nonlinear, and there might even be a sequence of tipping points. Can you figure three in your article for the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences kind of suggests that there might be three tiers of tipping points. The first between 1 to 3 degrees warming, and then between 3 to 5 degrees warming, and then another tipping point when we suddenly exceed 5 degrees. Can you talk to me about that?
Well, really what we're talking about, yes, in our figure three is a cascade of these, like a row of dominoes. And you start tipping the first dominoes, and they tip the next one, which tips the next one, and so on. And people are familiar, I think, with that analogy. But if you like, our tipping elements which sit in the 1 to 3 degree category are the dominoes at the front of the line of dominoes, and then the ones 3 to 5 are in the middle, and the ones 5 are at the end. So the idea is...
And go through those. What are the first ones? What are the second ones? What are the third ones?
Yeah, well, we've talked about one of the first ones, and that's the Arctic summer sea ice. We also think, by the way, up in the far north, the Greenland ice sheet might be vulnerable somewhere around 2 to 3 degrees. Coral reefs, which actually don't act too much as a domino, we think they're really vulnerable at 1.5. We'll lose most of them. The West Antarctic ice sheet, alpine glaciers. So there's a lot of vulnerable ice here that is thought to be have tipping points 1 to 3 degrees. And most of those are sort of in the polar areas. But they're going to unleash stronger regional warming. And if the warming then goes up toward 3 degrees, we have a whole set of tipping points which may be further vulnerable. One of them we talked about, the boreal forests, and we know that they're already showing signs of vulnerability a bit over 1 degree. So that may be an underestimate. We may see action at 2 degrees on the boreal forest. Nevertheless, they're put in the 3 to 5 at the moment. The Indian summer monsoon season, the North Atlantic circulation system, the Amazon forest are all in that category. Now, of course, the Amazon forest would release an enormous amount of carbon to the atmosphere as well. Then if you get those going, then you go back to the poles and there's some more recalcitrant ice that could be vulnerable at 5 degrees. That's the permafrost, which would release carbon. That's mainly in eastern Siberia. Ocean methane hydrates, that's methane stored in ocean sediments. And even the East Antarctic ice sheet, which is the big one. I mean, that's the big, very stable one. At 5 degrees, we're worried that could be unstable. So it acts like a wave of tipping elements that start at the poles, go down toward the mid-latitudes and equator, and then come back to the poles. So it's like a stack of a weaving stack of dominoes that once you start tipping them, the whole thing may go. So when you put that whole story together, we propose that there could be what we call a planetary threshold, which is once those dominoes start falling, you can't stop it. And that would equate to a threshold that would eventually take the Earth system onto that hothouse trajectory that we postulate in this paper.
Will Steffen was an eminent Earth system scientist, a native of Norfolk, Nebraska. Steffen emigrated to Australia in the 1970s, where he took up a position at the Australian National University in Canberra. Steffen served as the executive director of the International Geosphere Biosphere Program, a groundbreaking initiative aimed at studying the chemical, physical, and biological processes governing Earth as a system. Steffen's name has come to be associated with a host of ideas about planet Earth and humanity's fate, planetary boundaries, safe operating space. Steffen's great acceleration curves helped corroborate the idea first proposed by Paul Crutzen that planet Earth has entered a new epoch, the Anthropocene. Will Steffen passed away in January 2023. We'll link to his obituary and this conversation at greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, a joint production of Earth Chronicle Productions and 93.3 CFMU-FM, Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. Thanks to our news editor, Kylie Wong, and to GPM contributors Janelle Letan and Nathaniel Provost. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at cfmu.ca and greenplanetmonitor.net. You can also find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Blueberry, and on Canada's Harbinger Media Network. I'm David Kattenberg, over and out for now.
Can get is static or variations on the central musical rhythm.
I only wish there was some way we could tell it to shut up. It's driving me crazy. And it keeps getting louder.
We have no way of estimating the volume this creature can produce.
The only logical solution is to listen to CJS at 90.1 FM. They broadcast from Burnaby Mountain in British Columbia. Let's tune in now.
Who doesn't love music? Join the weekly discussion at the CJSF Record Club with other music aficionados checking out new releases and forgotten classics, exploring and learning about genres and loving music. Every Thursday at CJSF Burnaby from 4 p.m. till 5 p.m. Listen, learn, and share.